Hello. It's September 19th, 2024. My name is Simone, and this is 90s Crime Time. Welcome to a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time. And if you're new to 90s Crime Time, welcome to the show. Like always, I hope you all have had a great week so far and are preparing for the upcoming weekend. As for today's episode, I'll give out a short disclaimer saying that it's pretty graphic, pretty violent. So just viewer's discretion is advised. And with that, let's dive in to today's case. The year was 1992, and in a small section of Nova Scotia, Canada, was the small island area of Cape Breton. And within Cape Breton lay their largest city, Sydney River. Sydney River was once a community known as a steel and coal mining city. But over time, Sydney River became a big tourist destination due to its serenity and beauty. And tourists and natives considered the town safe. However, in 1992, when a crime so vicious occurred here, it would shake not only Nova Scotia, but Canada as a whole. In the following case, you'll find out what heinous act occurred here, the investigation, and the shocking aftermath in a case I title, Villains. In the early morning hours of May 7th, 1992, around 1 a.m., workers at the only McDonald's in Sydney River were doing their usual closing routine. Inside was 22-year-old Donna Warren, a swing shift manager who was counting money and doing nightly deposit amounts, and employee and Donna's good friend, 23-year-old Arlene McNeil, who was preparing decorations for a child's birthday that would be held the next day. Helping Arlene count decoration inventory was newly hired employee, 18-year-old Derek Wood, who wasn't supposed to be working that late, but offered to help Arlene. So Donna let him stay past his scheduled time off. In the kitchen area was floating maintenance worker and janitor, 29-year-old husband and father, Neil Burrows Jr. And also across town that night was another floating maintenance worker and janitor, 27-year-old James Jimmy Fagan. Around 1 a.m., Jimmy hailed a cab from Tim Hortons, which was near his home. And as the ride came to a close, Jimmy paid and got out to go to work. The cab driver watched as Jimmy made his way to the employee entrance and left to go back to driving in the night. But then the driver heard what sounded like a firecracker. Thinking that was strange, he glanced in his rearview mirror and saw two people run out of the McDonald's carrying cloth bags. He thought maybe they were employees needing a ride, But curiously, the two people ran in the opposite direction of the cab or any of the parked cars in the parking lot and into a field. The driver then saw the two people jump inside a car and it immediately sped off. The taxi driver felt something was wrong, so he put the cab in reverse and instinctively put his foot on the accelerator in hopes the screeching would get someone's attention from inside the McDonald's in case someone needed help. But no one came outside. Still feeling uneasy, the cab driver drove around past the drive-thru window and then came back to where he had dropped off Jimmy. And there in his vision, at the door, was Jimmy, lying on the ground in the doorway. Seeing this, the driver used his cab radio mic and told local dispatch that he thought his recent quote-unquote fare had been hurt, and that he saw him lying in the doorway of McDonald's in Sydney River. He added that it was a good idea to have an ambulance and police come. By now, other cab drivers heard the driver's call and asked him if they thought the rider was okay and to maybe check on him. But then another driver radioed in and warned him not to and to wait until they got there, as it could be dangerous. Shortly after the taxi driver made the emergency call, the second cab driver went to McDonald's to check the scene. Reports state that once the second driver came, both drivers got out to check on Jimmy. He was face down, and then the second driver carefully turned him over and noticed blood running down his face. Jimmy was also gasping for air and was clenching his teeth in pain. The second driver carefully rolled Jimmy on his back and then rushed back to his cab to get paper towels to try and stop the bleeding, while the first driver ran back to his cab to radio that they quickly needed emergency personnel and that he was sure Jimmy had been shot. The second driver frantically pressed the paper towels against Jimmy's forehead where the bullet hole lay. However, as he was tending to Jimmy, he heard the McDonald's office phone ring. Distracted and maybe hoping that would be help calling, the second driver made his way inside towards the office. But when he made it there, he noticed under the phone on the floor was a woman laying there covered in blood. It was Donna. The driver reached over her and picked up the phone, but when he answered, he only heard beeping noises. He hung up the phone and tried to help Donna, but reports state she was not moving and was staring blankly at him. The driver tried to tend to her, but sensing this was bigger than anything he could help, he headed back out to the first driver. But as he made his way back out, he looked to the side of him and in the kitchen area saw Neil lying on the floor near the sink, he too face down, lying in a pool of blood. He went over to check on Neil, lifted his right arm, and tried to check his wrist for a pulse, but couldn't find one. He tried to get closer to Neil's chest to find and try to listen to any signs of life, but he couldn't find or hear anything. Feeling very nervous, the second driver quickly made his way back out the door. But again, before he made it, he heard gurgling coming from the basement area and quickly tried to leave the scene. By this point, local police had gotten word about the shooting, but some in the department didn't take it seriously. After all, they were a small town, and crime, especially something like this, never happened. Reports state that when police received calls, it would mostly be about an accident, or if they received a call about a gunshot, it would usually turn out to be someone target practicing or a car backfiring. However, a detective made their way to McDonald's anyway, and when they pulled in, they were met by the taxi drivers. The first driver almost immediately told the detective about what he saw and heard and pointed to Jimmy laying in the doorway. The detective told him to pull his cab to the back of the lot and wait there until he was able to take a statement. Also by this point, and before the detective got inside the restaurant, a third taxi driver arrived and tried to render aid to Jimmy. The detective then approached McDonald's, and as he did, the second driver was making his way out of the restaurant, and he looked spooked. He screamed that there were bodies everywhere, and that he heard noises as if there was someone still alive in there. The driver tried to run away to his cab, but the detective grabbed him and told him to meet up with the first driver so he could take their statements later. The third driver also made his way to his fellow drivers. The detective then pulled out his gun and made his way towards the entrance. However, he stopped once he saw Jimmy injured and gasping for air. He then radioed for backup and said victims at McDonald's needed serious help. Eventually, the ambulance arrived, and once another detective came, they crept inside to clear the scene for medics to go in. As they made their way in, they split up. But as they made their way past Jimmy, they noticed a backpack edged by him and wondered if it was his, although Jimmy already had one on his body. Inside, one detective went to the basement and the other stayed at the main level. When the one detective made his way downstairs, he came across Arlene, who had been shot and was also gasping for air. The detective rolled her over to try and help her breathe and radioed the first detective that they needed medical downstairs and fast. As the call came in to the first detective, he had discovered Neil as well, but saw no sign of life. He then came across Donna, and she too was beyond help. After a full search throughout the restaurant, the first detective determined medics would only need to transport Arlene and Jimmy to the hospital, and that Neil Burrows and Donna Warren were dead. Meanwhile, as more police from the city and surrounding areas made their way to the scene, nearby at a convenience market, a couple buying cigarettes were about to pay when Derek, the newest employee of McDonald's, burst in and said he needed help. He yelled at the cashier to let him use the phone or dial for help because there had been a shooting at his job. The cashier was irritated at first and thought he was joking, but when he saw the look on his face, he immediately dialed RCMP, or Royal Canadian Mounted Police. As luck would have it, Detective Number 2 answered. Derek told the detective he was scared shitless and that he was there at McDonald's when the massacre began. He added that he was in the back near the employee entrance smoking and heard shots. He said he was outside near the metal doors, and after he heard shots, he dropped his backpack and bolted from the scene. Listening to Derek, the detective knew he had to get back to the scene, but he knew Derek would be a viable witness, so he took down Derek's number and address and told him he'd be in touch with him later in the morning. As the investigation continued, Arlene and Jimmy had been taken to the hospital, and detectives made death notifications to Donna and Neil's families. They continued to investigate the restaurant and noticed the safe had been open. Coins were scattered on the floor, and about $2,000 had been taken. Detectives figured now that the motive was robbery, and the killer or killers assaulted the workers due to collateral damage. As hours went on after the murders, police set up roadblocks to block traffic and people from coming near the scene. However, reports state shortly after setting up the roadblocks, Derek really wanted to get his statement out there and made his way back to McDonald's to talk to detectives. Reports state he was able to speak with Detective Number 2, and the detective asked him if he was the one who called earlier. Derek told him yes, and then almost immediately told the detective he was working earlier at McDonald's. He heard the shots and then ran. As he was talking, the detective noticed Derek was pale and shaky, but the detective asked him if he would like a ride to the station with him for additional questioning, and he agreed. As the detective drove Derek to the station, he noticed Derek twitching every once in a while and seemed very nervous. But he thought it was because he had just witnessed the shooting. But then the detective noticed a cut on Derek's right knuckle. When he questioned Derek about it, he said he cut it a couple days before the shooting while opening a can. The detective continued his questioning during the ride and asked Derek where he went after he said he ran after hearing the shots. Derek told him he went for a long walk. However, the detective thought it was odd Derek answered the question very quickly, but he thought maybe he'd been drinking. Despite this, the detective thought that before taking Derek to the station, he would take Derek back near the crime scene to retrace his steps, to try and get a first-hand view of a witness. Derek took the detective on a 30-minute long journey to where he said he went after he heard the shots. Then, the detective took him to the station. When questioning began, Derek told detectives after his shift was over, he decided to help Arlene do inventory for a kid's birthday party. He then said that after he was done, he decided to have a smoke break and went through the basement to get to the employee entrance out back, propping the door with his backpack. Then he finished by saying that while he was smoking, he heard two shots and ran down the route he had shown the detective earlier. After his statement, another detective came in and told him some of Derek's story didn't make sense. The biggest inconsistency was that they found no cigarette butts at the crime scene. Derek didn't give a clear answer, but then they asked him about propping open the employee entrance with his bag. Derek told them he did this because it would automatically shut and lock. However, when detectives used the door earlier, the door closed plenty of times, but did not lock automatically unless pushed hard. Also, after Derek made the call from the convenience market, when detectives investigated the market and looked at the call log, they noticed that Derek made a few calls to a certain number, but he never mentioned this. When they questioned Derek about who else he called, he told them he called his friend, Freeman McNeil, who was his ride to work that night. So detectives decided to take a trip to question Freeman and left Derek in the interrogation room. Reports state that when detectives got to the McNeil home, they were met by Freeman's mother. They told her they wanted to speak to Freeman about a friend he drove to McDonald's earlier that morning, And when she mentioned Derek, she confirmed to detectives he had called there several times around the time of the murders, but that Freeman wasn't at home and that he had come home later for a little while, but was gone again. As detectives left, Freeman's mother wished them good luck and told them she hoped they got the bad guys soon. Detectives then went back to the station and continued to confront Derek about his inconsistencies. But every time they would ask him a question or confront him, Derek would sink in his chair as he couldn't answer their questions. It got so bad that reports state he eventually formed his body into a fetal position and told them he wanted to speak to a lawyer. With Derek no longer talking for now, detectives really wanted to talk to Freeman. As luck would have it, when they went back to his home, he was there and started talking. He confirmed that he was with Derek on the night of the shooting and drove him to work. Freeman added that he told Derek to call him if he needed to be picked up from work, but that he didn't. He also said that after he dropped off Derek, hours later he went to pick up medicine for his girlfriend and saw his friend Darren Muse on his route. He said Darren hopped in and they simply went riding together back to meet up with Freeman's girlfriend. He also noted he saw police cars at the McDonald's later that night and thought it was a bad accident. After speaking with Freeman, detectives felt they had no reason to suspect him of foul play. Sometime after Freeman's interview, the next day on the 8th, detectives unfortunately learned that Jimmy Fagan's condition worsened and that he was only being kept alive on life support. With this, his family decided to donate his organs and took him off life support, making Jimmy the third victim of the McDonald's shooting. Meanwhile, after speaking to Freeman, detectives decided to track down Darren Muse. When they got to him at his parents' home, he told them that he was with Freeman. When he was asked what route they took back to get to Freeman's girlfriend's home, Darren apparently became a little nervous and said he couldn't remember because he was playing with the car's radio. Sensing his anxiety, detectives switched tactics and asked Darren how long he'd known Freeman and if he knew Derek. Darren said he had known both since elementary school. When asked about the shooting, Darren said he asked Derek about it, but Derek told him he wasn't allowed to talk about it. Then they asked Darren if he would be willing to take a drive with them to show them the route he and Freeman took on May 7th. Again, Darren said he couldn't remember. So one of the detectives asked Darren if he would be willing to take a polygraph test, because reports state detectives felt he wasn't totally honest, just like Derek. Darren told detectives he would call them in a day or so if he decided to corroborate. Since detectives couldn't force Darren to take the polygraph, felt Freeman was honest, and Derek had lawyered up, they felt they had no real suspects of the McDonald's shooting almost a week after the tragedy. Meanwhile, reports state a tip came in a few days after detectives spoke to Darren, and it was from a man who said he had information about the shooting and suspects. He told detectives on the night of the murder he was listening to his police scanner at home when news of the shooting was broadcast. He said while it was shocking, he felt very uneasy because he felt he immediately knew who was behind it. He further explained that several weeks before the shooting, he was approached by three young men he had not known that long about robbing McDonald's because they were sure they could get away with at least $200,000. He said they wanted to hire him as a lookout and as an enforcer who would knock out any employees who got in their way. He told detectives they planned it for April, and he said yes, but didn't think they were serious. So when the day of the original robbery came, he did not show up to the McDonald's. But when May 7th came, he heard about the shooting and panicked when he thought it was actually carried out by the three men. When detectives asked who the three men were, the witness said they were Derek Wood, Freeman McNeil, and Darren Muse, and that Derek worked at McDonald's. He also added Freeman obtained the gun from a loved one, and Darren was to use a Halloween mask. Detectives were struck and thrown for a loop because the Halloween mask was found, but had never been made public. They had a credible witness and were now sure they previously talked to the right suspects. As luck would have it, after detectives talked to the witness, Darren agreed to the polygraph and failed miserably. Freeman was also asked to take a polygraph, and he agreed, but he too failed. With the failed tests, police obtained search warrants for the residences of Derek, Darren, and Freeman, and found an enormous amount of evidence, including a handgun that was found in Freeman's car that matched casings at the crime scene. Detectives also received anonymous tips from other friends of the suspects, saying they found it suspicious they were buying new expensive items when they were known to be broke. With all the evidence and witness testimonies, police arrested Derek, Darren, and Freeman on May 16th and charged them with various charges, including murder, attempted murder, and robbery. At Derek's trial, he was called the mastermind of the robbery as he worked at the McDonald's and hired Darren and Freeman to be his accomplices. The prosecution also painted a picture that the young men weren't planning on being caught at the scene. But when Donna and Arlene caught them, all three men panicked, and that's when the attack began, as there could be no witnesses left. Reports state that the prosecution presented to the court that on the night of the attack, Derek propped the door with his backpack so Freeman and Derek could come in. When they crossed Donna and Arlene, they saw Darren wearing a mask and Derek and Freeman without masks. And Donna asked if they were joking. After all, if this was a robbery, why weren't they all wearing masks? And why would an actual employee help commit a robbery? Then reports state Derek, maybe because he panicked, shot Arlene in her face, and she immediately started gasping for air. Then Freeman suggested they had to hurry and get to the safe. So Freeman pulled out a shovel handle and stood over Arlene as Derek and Darren fled to the office to open the safe. However, after the two left the basement, they came across Neil cleaning the kitchen sink. And then Derek shot him in the head. However, prosecutors stated Neil did not die and fought Derek and Darren. Darren then pulled out a knife and stabbed Neil, but he kept fighting. Hearing the commotion, Freeman left the two women in the basement and went to help his friends. He then hit Neil with a shovel handle and then shot Neil with another wound to the head, ending Neil's life. Derek then realized he didn't know the safe's combination, so he went to get Donna and forced her up the stairs to the office. After Donna opened the safe, Derek shot her in the head and again in the eye, killing her. To his shock, there was only $2,000, not the minimum of $200,000 he hoped for. Lastly, prosecutors stated that around the time they got the money, Jimmy reported to work. But before Jimmy could say a thing, after trying to go through the employee entrance, Freeman shot Jimmy. Then the young men jumped over Jimmy's body and fled away. And although Arlene did not die at the scene or at the hospital, she was left permanently disabled. Eventually, Derek was found guilty of the attempted murder of Arlene McNeil and the first-degree murders of Donna Warren and Neil Burrows, as well as robbery and unlawful confinement. He was given a life sentence with no chance of parole for 25 years. Next, Darren went to trial, and he eventually pled guilty to the second-degree murder of Neil Burrows and to the robbery. Other charges he faced were dismissed as part of a plea bargain he had made with prosecutors. He was convicted and sentenced to life with no parole for 20 years. Lastly, Freeman was found guilty of the first-degree murder of Neil Burrows and the second-degree murder of Jimmy Fagan. He was given a life sentence with no parole for 25 years. Fast forwarding to 2012, Darren Muse was granted full parole, but prohibited from ever living in Sydney River or the surrounding communities. He is said to have moved to British Columbia. In 2015, Derek applied for parole, but it was denied, and he remains in prison. In 2019, Freeman McNeil was granted unescorted absences from prison once a month for personal development, which means that when he is eventually released, he will have refamiliarized himself with the area, has acknowledged his criminal behavior, and has matured since he had committed a crime. Although he maintains he didn't know that one of the other offenders was carrying a firearm until the robbery was underway, even though it was proven he was the one who shot and killed Jimmy Fagan. Freeman's day parole and Darren's release decision were met with great anger by the families of the victims. Unfortunately, in 2018, the now 46-year-old Arlene McNeil died from her lingering injuries in a care home facility. And although the Sydney River McDonald's opened a week after the murders, it eventually closed in 2000 and it was torn down. The story of the Sydney River McDonald's massacre comes from the sources of CTV, the Calgary Herald, the Edmonton Journal, and others I'll put in the notes. Right. So I know that one was a lot. This case, so in the City River McDonald's massacre, was a lot. With that, I'm just not going to do a long think piece because there was a lot to take from this story. So I wanted you all to think of your own opinions and draw your own conclusions from this case. I will have a post on this case on my Instagram tomorrow, hopefully Friday, and maybe you can leave comments there. But I will go ahead and say, I think the whole thing was obviously preventable. All robberies are preventable, in my opinion. And I think it was quite dumb. Now, I know we're all young and silly, but even when I worked at a Little Caesars back when I was 16 years old, 16 through 17 years old, I don't think I ever thought a safe would have a minimum of $200,000. I never even thought about robbing anyone, but it's just common sense. Most fast food places do not have $200,000 in the store, in the restaurant, because why? For what? That's just so stupid. And rest in peace to all the victims. They did not deserve this. Even I believe Donna would have given them the money. I know they killed her, even though she opened the safe for Darren. That's just so stupid and ridiculous. And I think it was all preventable. And poor Neil, he had no idea what was going on. Jimmy didn't know what was going on. Poor Arlene, she was a law student. And then she was permanently disabled because of these idiots. And, I'm not sure what I believe about Darren and Freeman having parole. Maybe they should last there longer, stay in there longer, because four people eventually died, even though Arlene died decades later. I do think maybe they should have stayed in prison longer. Derek is right where he needs to be, in my opinion. I hope he doesn't come out anytime soon, since he was the mastermind. And just let me know what you all think of this case on Instagram. Hopefully, like I said, I will have a post for this episode tomorrow, Friday, September 20th, on the Instagram page where you can comment about the case that you heard this evening. And that's it. Thank you for tuning in to a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time, and I hope you found it interesting. If you like what you heard and have not done so, please leave a review for 90s Crime Time, hopefully a good one. But if not, I understand. I will try to continuously be better. You can also follow 90s Crime Time on Instagram, like I mentioned, where I frequently post other 90s stories, primarily on the weekend. And with that said, stay safe and healthy, and I will see you soon for a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time.